welcome to Cellular Healing TV. I'm your host, Meredith Dykstra, and this is episode number 175. We have our resident cellular healing specialist, Dr. Dan Pompa, on the line. And today we welcome back, no stranger to Cellular Healing TV, Dr. Jason Fung. And Jason has joined us on Cellular Healing TV a few times. We've really delved into fasting, a subject of which he's an expert in. But today we're going to talk about something a little bit different, obviously connects to fasting, but we're going to delve into diabetes. And really some natural solutions to treating it. So if you guys missed Dr. Fung's episodes prior to this one, he was on episode 112 and 160, so you can check those out. And before we dive in, let me tell you a little bit about Dr. Fung, just in case you missed the others. Dr. Fung earned his medical degree at the University of Toronto, where he also completed his internal medicine residency before heading to the University of California, Los Angeles, for his fellowship in nephrology. He currently practices as a kidney specialist in Toronto. During the course of treating thousands of patients, it became clear to Dr. Fung that the epidemic of type 2 diabetes and obesity was getting worse. The prevailing dietary recommendations to reduce dietary fat and calories were clearly ineffective. He founded the Intensive Dietary Management Program to provide a unique treatment focus for type 2 diabetes and obesity. Rather than focusing on medications, this clinic focuses on dietary changes that are simple yet effective. And you can learn more at his blog, intensivedietarymanagement.com, of which I'm a subscriber. It's an amazing blog. So thank you so much for coming back, Dr. Fung, and for the topic today.
Thanks for having me. Very exciting to be back.
Yeah, Doc, listen, you are a hero in our world because you've done so many of the studies and been a part of so many studies that we have a group of doctors who believe strongly in fasting and intermittent fasting. And really, I would say a very unique way of addressing insulin resistance, diabetes, hormone resistance. And the topic today is diabetes. So I want to jump right in, you know, and really, you have a unique view of type 2 diabetes, and I want you to explain that to our viewers. And we have just lay people watching this that need to understand this, and we have doctors that are watching this that need to understand this, because the old thought of just, hey, the receptors, you know, are affected and, you know, blunting out, you really have a unique way of looking at the liver as the big part of this whole thing, and you know, forcing in glucose to the body may make glucose levels in the blood look better, but it sure is killing us slowly. But explain it from the top, right? I mean, explain the standard view of how we look at diabetes, type 2 diabetes, and explain your view better, which in your book you've addressed in even in the Complete Guide of Fasting. And I've, you know, read a lot of your blogs that address it as well. But start right there, Doc.
Sure. So this is actually very interesting because I'm actually finishing the manuscript on a type 2 diabetes specific book, which is going to be coming out very soon in 2018. So this is kind of a whole different way of looking at type 2 diabetes. So first of all, just to back up a little bit, there's two types of diabetes, type 1 and type 2 diabetes. So when it first started, it was type 1 was kind of the focus, because a lot of children predominantly were getting this illness, and they'd be passed, their blood glucose would rise very high, they would lose all kinds of weight, and then they would die. So what they found was that they were severely lacking insulin. So insulin is a hormone that allows the glucose to go into the cells to be used for energy. And it's really the energy storage sort of hormone. When you eat, insulin goes up, your body stores energy. So if you have virtually zero insulin like these children are having, your body couldn't store any of the incoming food energy. So you would basically waste away, then you'd die. So in 1921, at the University of Toronto, they discovered insulin, they purified it, gave it to these kids kind of miraculously got better. But unfortunately, the story of diabetes didn't really end there, because there was another type of diabetes which soon became very evident. So by the 50s and 60s, they started monitoring insulin levels, and it was clear that there's two groups. There's those children that had severe lack of diabetes, severe lack of insulin, and you gave them insulin, they did fine. Then you had this group of sort of older overweight, obese people in their 50s and 60s, and you gave them insulin, and well, nothing really happened that was all that great. You'd give them a bit of insulin, then they need more and more and more. So it is clear that there's two groups, and these older people didn't actually have too little insulin. Their insulin levels were actually very high. So what they had, in fact, was something called insulin resistance. So the insulin is there, but it's not moving that glucose from the blood into the cell. And the question was why. Nobody really kind of understood what the sort of basic problem was, what caused all this insulin resistance. So there's all kinds of theories. For a long time, people thought dietary fat was a problem, dietary cholesterol, all kinds of problems. So this is what we see now. In fact, today, if we fast forward today, 90 to 95% of diabetes is in fact type 2 diabetes. So for the rest of, or most of the rest of the talk, when I refer to diabetes, it'll refer to type 2 diabetes, because that's predominantly what I deal with as an adult physician. So that's just to be clear. So if you're type 1, yes, there you have to take this, you have to understand that. So the question is, what causes this insulin resistance? So people have this sort of lock and key paradigm. So mm-hmm. what that means is that insulin is considered like a key, and the cell, it is walled off, it has a wall, so that glucose can't go in. Nothing can go in without the cell kind of letting it go in. So you have a gate, and insulin's like a key. It opens the gate, and it allows the glucose to go from the blood into the cell. And what they said was that, well, something has happened that this key and this gate no longer kind of fit together very well, and therefore the glucose is staying outside and not getting into the cell, and that's why the blood glucose is high, which causes all the symptoms. So when your blood glucose is high, that's what we call diabetes. What they said was that because the glucose wasn't going into the cell, your cell was facing a sort of internal starvation, because all the glucose is outside, it's not inside. And certainly in type 1 diabetes, that's the case. In type 2 diabetes, it is much harder to make the case that these are internally starving people, because when you look at them, they're obviously overweight. Their livers are huge and filled with fat. Their pancreases are full of fat. Their bellies, they have these huge kind of central adiposity, which is the weight that gathers around the midsection. And it didn't look anything like these children who are dropping weight at an alarming rate. So, but when they tried to understand it, they said, well, we don't understand it. The insulin molecule is clearly not changed. The receptor, you can clone the receptor, you can test receptor. Receptor is fine. So both the key and the gate were completely normal, but it wasn't working. So what they said was, well, there's something gumming up the mechanism, just like if you had some gum and stuck it into the lock, well, then your key is fine, your gate is fine, but it's not working because there's something in there that's blocking. So if you think about it that way, then the natural solution is to kind of pump up the insulin. So that was the strategy for years and years, for decades, really. So if you had type 2 diabetes, you'd take medication. When the medication wasn't enough, they'd give insulin. So if you think about the lock and key model, you're producing a lot of keys. Each key doesn't really work, but there's so many of them that you could get the glucose into the cell. So that's what we did. For up until about 2008, that was the prevailing view of almost everybody in the world, including myself, that the high blood glucose was what causes all the damage. You simply give enough insulin to get this glucose into the cell and you'll be fine. When they actually tested that theory, so in 2008, 2009, several large studies came out. It was the ACCORD study, the ADVANCE study, the VADT, and there's been several since then, which showed that what they studied was, does giving all this medication and insulin to lower the blood glucose really make you healthier? Does it prevent heart attacks? Does it prevent strokes? Does it prevent death? Because obviously type 2 diabetics were very sick. And we all thought the answer was a obvious yes, but it turned out that the answer was not at all. Patients were not healthier at all.
Yeah, just right there. I mean, from a clinical perspective, right? You know, my group of doctors, you know, we get the patients in that are on the different medications, you know, and there's many, right, that take the glucose from the blood and put it somewhere, and their blood glucose is normal, right? So that, you know, God forbid they come off the medication, because then their blood glucose rises. I love your analogy in that you're basically saying, okay, great, you're taking the garbage from the kitchen and you're stuffing it places. This is what the medication does. So you're taking it and you're putting it under the sink, and maybe you're throwing it into the bathroom. The kitchen looks great. It looks clean. However, after a period of time, the rot starts, right? Now, we could call that diabetic neuropathy. We could call that, you know, deterioration of cartilage, whatever it is. You know, diabetics die. So we know this. I've known this for years, that just because your glucose is normal and you're on diabetic medication, it seems to do nothing for, you know, the degenerative symptoms that go along with diabetes. You've answered this, right? So that analogy, I think, and you can expand upon it, I think it really gets our average viewer to understand what's going on here.
Yeah, absolutely. So this lock and key paradigm wasn't really correct. So the way to really understand type 2 diabetes insulin resistance is really that this is an overflow paradigm. So when you think about it, well, you have glucose that's not getting into the cell, but why is the insulin, why is that key not working anymore? Maybe that cell is so full already of glucose that you can't shove any more in. And that's the idea, that what's happening is not that there's something wrong with the key and the lock and that mechanism, but that the cell is just so full that it's actually shoving it out. Just like if you had a suitcase, for example, and you're trying to put in your t-shirts. At first, when you put in your t-shirts, it's fine. But once it's completely full, you just can't put in those last two t-shirts. And there's nothing wrong with the t-shirt. There's nothing wrong with your luggage. There's nothing wrong. But it's full. That's the whole problem. And it's the same thing with our body. What we've done is we've taken this sugar and we shoved it into our cells. And over the decades, we shove in more and more and more until the cell is finally full. Now when you try and shove it in, it doesn't go in. But the answer is not to keep shoving with more and more force. That's the real problem. If you keep shoving it in, what happens is that it fills up. And then your body says, okay, no more. So the blood glucose spills out again. And then what you do is you go to your doctor gives you insulin. Insulin doesn't get rid of that glucose. It merely takes that blood glucose and just rams it into your body. Your body goes, whoa, and then it accepts a bit more for a little while. And then it fills up again, and then the glucose starts spilling out again. So you go back to your doctor, and your doctor doubles up your dose of insulin. So you're really cramming it in. And that's the whole problem. You keep cramming it in, cramming it in. So what you've done is you've taken the blood from the glucose where you could see it, and you just basically shoved it somewhere where you couldn't see it. Because where does this all go? Well, your body, you shoved all this glucose back in the cell. It goes back into the liver, and the liver packages up as fat and sends it all over the body. So all this glucose goes into your eyes and your kidneys and your nerves and your heart and everything. And over the decades, everything just starts to rot. And that's why diabetes affects every single part of our body, because you're shoving all this stuff everywhere where it's not supposed to go. And then pretending it's fine because you're saying, well, look at my blood glucose, it's fine. So just like if you hide, instead of throwing the garbage out, you hide it away under your bed. Well, you're not any better. So if you hide the glucose, which you should have got rid of, into your cell, well, you're not any healthier. So what's interesting is that it's a very powerful paradigm, because the problem really to understand type 2 diabetes is really it's just too much sugar in the body, not in the blood. If it's the blood, then you can still hide it away. But it's in your whole body, you have too much. So I give the analogy of a sugar bowl. You imagine your body is just like a sugar bowl. So over the years, it fills up. Then when you eat, the sugar comes in and spills out into the blood. What you don't want to do is take that sugar and just shove it back in. You got to get rid of it. So up until now, all the drugs simply shove that glucose out of the blood into the body, and therefore they didn't see any benefits. There's actually a new class of medication called SGLT2s, which actually cause you to excrete the sugar in your urine. So you actually pee out more glucose. And what's very interesting about this is that the recent studies, which just came out a year and a half ago, is that despite the fact that these drugs don't really lower your blood glucose very much. They're about as half as effective.
It had a significant effect on heart disease, though. I read the study.
Yeah, absolutely. It reduced heart disease by like 25%, reduced death by like 30%, reduced kidney disease by so much, despite the fact that it didn't lower blood glucose because they're doing the right thing. What's very interesting about this is that that is actually the body's own protective mechanism. Because if you think about it, the problem is too much sugar. What we've done is we've taken sugar, sugar, sugar. We've filled up our bodies. Our body sends it out everywhere. But eventually what it does is the blood glucose goes up and you pee out the sugar. And everybody thinks that's a bad thing, but that's actually your body's protective response at trying to dump out this toxic glucose load. So that's the reason everybody has this. That's why you have the renal threshold, which is a level of blood glucose above which your body doesn't absorb anymore, because your body says, whoa, I have enough. I am just dumping the rest of it out. So it's actually a protective mechanism. And now what we do is we take insulin, we shove all that glucose out of the blood into the cells, we actually eliminate that protective mechanism we had before, and there we are. But with these medications, what you see is that there's a protective effect. So it's I call this a new paradigm of insulin resistance. And yeah, that's really one of the one of the exciting things, because what it does is it opens up the entire field to reversal. Because if the problem is too much sugar, if you understand type 2 diabetes is simply a problem of too much sugar, there's only two things you need to do.
Yeah.
Don't put it in and burn it off.
Which there lies the answer.
Yeah. Both are completely natural and completely free. We don't need anything but knowledge to reverse this entire disease that affects like 52%.
We'll get to the answer in a minute. But I want you to say, you know, something we see clinically, and I you're the scientist, I always draw back to clinically. You know, we see that the skinnier diabetics have the fattiest liver, and then the fatter diabetics typically you don't see as fatty of a liver. So meaning that you eat this sugar, you can only do two things with it. Well, I guess three. You could burn it, right? But there's so much that you can't burn. So you store some as stored sugar and glycogen, or you store it as fat somewhere. Kind of explain that, because, you know, our viewers have to understand this, you know, as far as like what, how this, you know, where it's going and the whole fatty liver and why that can make things even worse. Explain that a little bit.
Yeah, so that's a good question, because everybody always talks about the skinny diabetic, but if you look at them, they have big fatty livers. And the problem is not actually the body fat. It's actually the so-called ectopic fat or abdominal fat, which is the fat in the liver, the fat in the pancreas, the fat around the organs that's not supposed to be there.
Yeah.
Fat inside a fat cell is fine. That's what it's supposed to do. But fat inside the liver is not fine, because the liver is not supposed to have it. So what happens when you take excessive carbohydrates, but particularly fructose, and we'll get back to fructose in a second, is that your insulin goes up, your body starts to store sugar. Now, you can store sugar in two ways. Basically, you can store it as sugar, or you can store it as fat. Sorry, you can store food energy in two ways.
Right.
Either sugar or fat. You can't store proteins for energy.
Right.
So when you eat, your body stores glycogen, and that's chains of sugar. It goes into the liver, and there's a limited capacity for it. So the advantage of the glycogen system is that you can take that food energy in and out very, very easily. So if you eat, it goes into the liver, but when you don't eat, for example, when you're asleep, it comes back out of the liver. It's really, really fast. It's really, really easy. So it's kind of like the refrigerator. You can put food there, and it's easy to put in. It's easy to take out. Body fat is a different form of storage. And it has, it's much harder to get to. So when you take excessive carbohydrates, it fills up the glycogen. If your glycogen's full, your body actually creates new fat. And that's called de novo lipogenesis. So you take the glucose and you actually change it into fat. And that gets sent out of the liver to the fat cells. And so body fat is harder to get to. So it's harder to get the stores of energy that are locked away in the body fat. but there's unlimited amount of storage, as everybody knows. You can store a lot of body fat. So you have kind of two complementary systems. One has limited storage, but easy in and out, and one has unlimited storage, but it's hard to get in and out. So it's kind of like your freezer. Yeah, so it's like in the basement. You put in the freezer. It's there if you need it, but it's not so easy to get to, but you can carry a lot of stuff in there. So you actually have two complementary systems. What the problem is that if you store the fat, so as you eat excessive carbohydrates and insulin, insulin goes up, and then it creates the fat. So you're creating the fat and you're shuttling it out to the fat cells. The problem is when you have excessive insulin, then you create fatty liver. So the fat is backing up. So you're putting glucose into the system. The glucose storage is full. So now we assume the glycogen is full. As you pour in more glucose, the liver has to make fat and get it out of there. If you put in too much, if you kind of overwhelm the export mechanism, all that fat just backs up. And then you get this big, giant, fatty liver. And that's what causes insulin resistance. Right. Because now you're pouring glucose in, but you're not getting the fat out fast enough the other side. So the liver says, okay, no more. I can't take anymore. So stop it. So that's when everything backs up and the glucose goes into the blood. And that's insulin resistance. Fructose, which is half of sugar, so table sugar is sucrose, half fructose, half glucose, and high fructose corn syrup is roughly the same, slightly more fructose. Fructose is actually very, very important. It's actually the most important input into the system, because what happens is that fructose cannot be used by any cell in the body. So every cell in your body uses glucose. When you eat glucose, so starches like flour, white bread. Say you eat white bread, it's all glucose. There's some fructose in there, but that's added in. But if you just eat rice, for example, it's all glucose, not fructose. Well, that glucose can be used by your whole body. So if you're 170 pounds, for example, then all 170 pounds of your body is using that glucose. But fructose is not the same. Nobody uses fructose. The only place it can go is directly to the liver, and only the liver metabolizes fructose. So what happens is that when it gets to the liver, the fructose, there's only kind of one of three paths. You can burn it, but nobody's going to burn it because you're just changing into glucose and you're eating at the time that you're taking in this fructose, so there's no need to burn it. The other thing is you can change it to glucose, but that's hard, or you change it into fat. So once again, fructose essentially goes directly into new liver fats or de novo glycogenesis.
Right. And by the way, let me say a word on that real fast, because you know, if you go to the Diabetes Association website, they still recommend fructose for diabetics. Why? Because fructose, as you pointed out, doesn't raise blood glucose, right? So yes. As it goes in, it's only processed in the liver. So on the surface, it looks like, hey, this is a really safe sugar for diabetics to, you know, consume. However, what you're saying is the fact that it goes right into the liver and makes fatty liver, it is actually contributing to the larger portion of the problem. Now, today we have something very unique. You know, no time in the history of man have we seen basically fatty liver in the children. And it is because of the amount of fructose they're consuming and all the energy drinks and sport drinks, and they're loaded with fructose. And, you know, of course the drinks from the time they were babies, they're giving them orange juice and this juice and that juice, the amount of fructose we're consuming, we're seeing fatty liver, non-alcoholic fatty liver in children, you know, and I've heard fructose is being called alcohol without the buzz, meaning it's the same thing. Alcohol can only be processed in the liver, and that's why it creates fatty liver. Is there the same correlation there with alcohol?
Absolutely. Absolutely the same correlation. And it is scary because if you look at diabetic clinics in children, pediatric clinics, used to be all type 1s. Now it's like 50-50 type 1 and type 2. It's a scary thing. But the problem with the fructose is that if you think about it, so sucrose, table sugar, is 50% glucose, 50% fructose. But what happens is that say you eat, you know, a pound of sugar is half a pound of glucose, but all 170 pounds of body uses that glucose. Right. That same amount of fructose goes to like 5 pounds of liver.
Yeah.
So it all goes directly into liver fat. So in terms of causing diabetes, the fructose is something like 20 or 30 times worse than the glucose. It's much, much, much worse. And that's the real problem. And you see it all over the place. For example, in China, for example, is a very interesting case study. Because in 1980, about 1% of the population had type 2 diabetes. Now it's about 11%, so 10, 11-fold increase in a single, like in 30 years. A single generation, it's gone up an incredible 11 times. That's ridiculous. Yeah. But if you look back at the diet in 1980, 1990, the amount of white rice they're eating is off the charts. It's way higher than anybody in the United States or the United Kingdom. And yet they had no diabetes, practically zero diabetes, 1%, practically no diabetes, and yet they're eating 300 grams a day of carbohydrates, refined carbohydrates, because it's all white rice. There's no brown rice. There's none of that, right? So how do they do that? Well, the point is they don't eat any sugar at all. Their intake of sucrose was virtually zero. So they had no diabetes. But now they're eating sugar, you know, they've become westernized. So now they eat cakes and bread and all this stuff. And now they're actually the highest proportion of diabetes in the world, beating even the United States, which is super scary because now they have this kind of tradition of rice, white rice, high carbohydrates, and now they take that sugar and they're toast. They're really in a lot of trouble. And that's the thing, that sugar tracks much more closely to the incidence of type 2 diabetes than carbohydrates, than body weight, than anything else. In fact, it's scary because the average body mass index of an Asian diabetic is like, I think it's 23.7. So that's normal weight. That's 20 to 25 is normal weight. 25 to 30 is overweight, and over 30 is obese. So they're actually in the normal weight category, and yet they're all developing. That's the average. This is like really, really scary. They're all developing because they're all getting all this directly into that liver because of the very high refined carbohydrates, because of the fructose. So it's basically glucose, fructose. That's the root of the problem, is sugar.
Well, where does fruit fit in? Fruit's high in fructose, right? So how does that fit in? I mean, obviously, our bodies are able to take in a certain amount of fructose, but obviously, it's the overconsumption. Talk about that.
Yeah, it's really one of the first principles of toxicology is really the dose makes the poison. So if you look at whole fruit, the amount of fructose, there's fructose there for sure. Yeah. But if you look at the amount that they're eating in 1915, 1920, it's very little compared to what we eat today. So what happened then, of course, was that they had the sugar plantations, you know, in the Deep South and the Caribbean, they had those sugar plantations. So back in the 1900s, early 1900s, there's very little sugar. They didn't have much fructose at all. Then the sugar plantations came and gradually went up, and then high fructose corn syrup was a real changer because now you could process it not out of sugar beet but out of corn, and there's a lot of corn. So the prices of this high fructose corn syrup basically went to almost like zero practically. Yeah. So everybody put it everywhere they could because it was cheap as anything. So all these processed foods just put it wherever they could, and the amount went up. So if you look at the sugar sweetened beverages and amount percentage of calories people were eating at its peak, I think teens were eating almost 25% of their calories as sugar. It was like ridiculously high. Things have changed though. If you look at from 2000 onwards with this real kind of focus on sugar, you can see that there's been a tremendous drop. I mean, obviously we're not out of the woods, but there has been a drop. So the message has gotten through, but the fructose is really, really much worse than the other one. So that's why if you're talking about type 2 diabetes or pre-diabetes, the very first thing you got to get rid of is all the added sugars. And what that realistically means is getting rid of almost all processed foods, because almost all processed foods have that.
Yeah, it's the hidden sugars, that corn syrup. I mean, you know, ketchup, corn syrup, right? I mean, every, you know, canned foods, corn syrup. Corn syrup's everywhere. Like you said, it's just, it's all about the money. corn syrup is a cheap sweetener and it markets well because people don't even recognize it as sugar actually, right? I mean, the average person looks at it and go, oh, you know, they know sucrose or dextrose perhaps, they don't understand the corn syrup. But anyways, you know, okay, let's get into the solution because, I mean, you know, herein lies the problem, right? And you tapped in a little bit on the solution there, right? I mean, we either have to, you know, burn it down or not put it in, right? So let's talk about it. And that kind of piggybacks, you know, here we have the person with the fatty liver, you know, obviously type 2 diabetes. We have a unique answer, right? We do something, and we've talked a lot about fasting, intermittent fasting and things. Talk about it.
Yeah, so really, if you think about it, it's a very simple solution. Actually, well, let me back up. It's not just the fatty liver. So once that liver gets all fatty, it starts sending all this fat out. And the other key place it goes is the pancreas.
Yeah.
So you get this fatty pancreas. And here's the second part of what happens is that the fat kind of clogs up your pancreas so that it can't secrete the insulin. So what you see is that as the insulin levels start to drop off, so then again, this is actually one of your body's
And this explains why we thought the beta cells would burn out, what we would call pre-diabetes. This is a unique thing that I've read from you.
Yeah, so what happens is that everybody thought that it's because the pancreas has been secreting so much for so long that it's just all burnt out. It can't be true for a few reasons. One is that if you look at children, there's no way that their pancreases are burnt out by like age 7, right? That'd be ridiculous and really scary. Second of all, some people said, well, the high glucose is what burned out the pancreas cells. But you can't because the pancreas is producing so much insulin, glucose levels stay relatively good until after the pancreas starts to fail. That is to say, the pancreas fails and then the glucose goes up. It's not the glucose goes up and then the pancreas fails. So everybody says, oh, the glucose is what kills the pancreas. Not at all. The glucose is fine. When the pancreas starts to fail, then the glucose goes up. So you can't say the glucose is what killed the pancreas. So the third thing is that when you can actually make that pancreas work better. So we know that from studies of, for example, bariatric surgery. So in bariatric surgery, where you have a severe, sudden caloric drop, that diabetes, so you can take a 500-pound man and on 400 units of insulin, and I've seen it, you do bariatric surgery, and 2 weeks later, they're actually completely non-diabetic.
Yeah.
And they're still massively overweight. They haven't lost a lot of weight yet. Diabetes is completely gone in like 2 weeks. And everybody says, how does that happen? How does that happen? Well, what happens is that the body actually pulls out your fat preferentially. When you go to a very, very low calorie diet, first of all, remember, your body stores glycogen and body fat. So you can exhaust your glycogen in about 24 hours. But then when you start to burn body fat, the first place it goes is that stuff that's in your pancreas and in your liver, which is great because that's what causes all the problems. So that's how you can reverse that type 2 diabetes in 3 weeks in these surgical cases, which everybody knows about, because those pancreas cells weren't burnt out. You can measure them and you can see that they're starting to secrete more insulin again. So that's again, great news. Because now all of a sudden you open up you have light at the end of the tunnel. It's not like your pancreas is burnt out. And this is how doctors kept telling patients, oh, it's chronic, it's progressive, your pancreas is burnt out, there's nothing you can do about it. No, that pancreas was merely clogged up with fat. As soon as you unclog that fat, it's going to get better. And several doctors have actually done MRI studies of this fatty pancreas. What they found is that you only have to remove 0.6 grams of fat from that pancreas to get it going again.
Oh, wow.
That's a minuscule amount. That's crazy small. So that's great news, because if that's the strategy, then hey, again, burning it off, intermittent fasting is a perfect strategy. Because one, you're not putting it in, you're not putting anything in, so there's no anything. It's not just carbohydrates. You got nothing going in. But because your body must have energy in order to function, you're going to start burning. So in the first 24 to 36 hours, for example, you're going to burn that glycogen and maybe a little bit of protein, and then you're going to get into fat burning. So from then on, your body is immediately going to go to the intraorganic fat, the fat inside the liver, the fat inside the pancreas, and that's where you see your insulin requirements. If you're on insulin, the insulin requirements go down dramatically.
Yeah.
Medications go down dramatically. If you start having people do longer fasts, you'll see it very quickly. So it's a crazy situation, because I see people, and after like a month, they're off of everything. It's like crazy how fast they get better. And it's like, well, I actually knew that already from the studies on bariatric surgery, but it's still incredible to watch these people who've been on insulin for 15 years and in a month they're off. It's like, wow, that is great. And here their doctors had been telling them, oh, you're always going to be on for the rest of your life, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, yeah, you've been taking insulin for 10 years for no reason. It was because people weren't treating the proper problem. And all stems back to that sort of misunderstanding of this kind of lock and key, internal starvation. That's type one. That's not type two. Type two is an overflow. And that's the real difference.
We were talking off air, you know, and I was talking about clinically, you know, with my group of doctors, what we're doing, what we're seeing. And, you know, we step one, we move people into a low carbohydrate diet, even into ketosis, right? And then step two, we start intermittent fasting, you know, where we push out maybe 15 hours. You know, they're getting more fat adapted. In the beginning, they're hungry all the time, right? You know, and eventually they start adapting. And then our conversation was, then we start throwing in days of the week where they just eat one meal, giving more time for what you're saying, right? Because during that time, as they became more fat adapted, their body's going to start burning out that fat out of the pancreas and out of the liver, right? And then we throw in even a longer fast, maybe a 42-hour fast, you know, so we're just giving more and more time to empty, you know, that fat out of those organs. And I'm telling you, it is remarkable. Then once they get even more efficient, then we can do them a longer fast. And, you know, therein lies a very, very unique answer. Now, I want you to speak to something, because in February, this past February, 2017, there was a study, I believe, in Cell that looked at a partial fast, taking people between 500 and 1100 calories. And they found that, you know, now they spoke about beta cell regeneration. Now, what they noticed was a lot of the things we're talking about. Was it beta cell regeneration? Was it that they just became activated again? I know you know the study. What is your thoughts on it?
I think it's basically you're just unclogging
the
pancreas. Is there regeneration potentially? Although I think that's not a huge part of why people get better, because it's really too fast. So if you look at Dr. Royce Taylor's work, and he's been doing this for several years now, he doesn't do a full fast. He does sort of this 500, 800.
Yeah, right. I call it a partial fast, yeah.
Yeah, you're getting into the range where you're going to see some benefits, but to me, it doesn't make any sense to do 500, 800 calories. I mean, these are sick people. You might as well do the full thing, because it's a powerful dietary strategy. And absolutely, I what he showed was recovering pancreatic function. So when you measure the insulin response, it was low before and now is going up. That sort of idea of regeneration came from the idea that they were burnt out. I don't think they were ever burnt out.
You know, I want to go back and actually read it. I didn't to the depth to see were they actually seeing regenerated beta cells? How were they measuring that? Or was it because the function was up? I can't answer that. I didn't read it close enough. But
I think it was the recovery of the pancreatic function. So some people sort of interpreted that. So you do this first insulin response, and what you see is that over 8 weeks, I think they do, so 800 calories a day for 8 weeks.
Right.
And over 8 weeks. Now, the fat comes out of the liver much faster, because the insulin resistance, you can measure insulin resistance, and he has as well. Insulin resistance drops very quickly, so that gets better very quickly. But the pancreatic problem actually takes a lot longer. So it takes many, many weeks before you see. And it's even still getting better over 8 weeks. So it's harder to get it out of the pancreas. The liver fat seems to come out very quickly. So what you do is you measure the pancreatic response. Like, it should produce a certain amount of insulin, but it's very low. But over those 8 weeks, you can actually show that it starts to get better and better. It's a fascinating study, and again, completely disproves this idea that they were completely burnt out in the first place. So, I mean, that's really important work, I think, that's been done.
Yeah. You know, where does even part of the epigenetic component come in? Maybe too, that when the cell fills up, that it's sending a signal to the receptors even to shut off, right? I mean, it makes sense, right? We know that the DNA can send a signal to the receptor and, you know, blunt the receptor, so to speak, but really it's driven by the innate intelligence to do so at different times, right? In times of starvation, whatever it is. You know, so, I mean, as the cell fills, then we could experience a receptor that doesn't work as well, but it's because this body was so smart to even blunt it, if you will. Does that even make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And it comes back to the point about the fat cells. So it's interesting because some people look at obesity as actually a protective response, because what you're doing is you've got all this excessive sugar and your liver actually is trying to protect itself by sending it out into the fat cells. And what you there's a ton of studies looking at the adipocyte, which is the fat cell size. The bigger your adipocyte, the more insulin resistance you have. Well, of course, that's just like the suitcase. The more clothes you put in it, the harder it's going to be to stuff it full. So the fat cell is the same, the more you stuff it full. But the point of the fat cell is that it kind of holds it in a safe place so that it's not backing up into the liver. So you have these rare humans that have zero fat. It's very interesting because they have no fat at all. And they have the worst insulin resistance you've ever seen.
I've seen it. Yep.
Yeah, it's crazy because what happens, of course, is that their fat cells cannot store fat. So all the fat stores in the liver. So you get immediate insulin resistance with everything. So they have the worst cases you've ever seen. So fat cells is actually, again, everybody thinks it's so bad, but it's actually trying to protect their cells from this excessive sugar load. Everything comes back to this kind of toxic sugar load, sugar being glucose and fructose. And that's a protective response. Your fat is, you know, you're becoming obese really to hold it away from the really damaging fat, which is the fat in your liver, fat in your pancreas. And that takes decades. But finally, you kind of overcome your body's resistance to that protection. And the next step is that the liver says, no more, don't give me any more. So then the blood glucose goes up. And then when the blood glucose goes up, you start spilling it out in your urine, which everybody says, oh, that's bad. No, that's good, because the problem was you have too much. The pancreas is the same. The pancreas clogs up and stops producing insulin so that your blood glucose shoots up and can start spilling out. Yes, you have to pay a price. You have the symptoms. You have the high urine output. You have the thirst and weight loss. But in fact, that was all protecting you from what was the real underlying cause of the whole thing, which was just too much sugar.
And the body's amazing. It just wants to survive, right? Obesity is a survival mechanism.
Yeah. And so what we thought was really a pathophysiology, we thought it was a disease state, is actually a natural protective factor. And that's why everybody in the world has this response. Like, everybody in the world's getting diabetes, getting fat, and it's why? Is it a maladaptive response? Well, obviously not. The human body is incredibly smart. We think it's always stupid. Like, your body's so stupid, you have to give it insulin. It's like, you know, we were really stupid to think that we were smarter.
I couldn't echo that more. It's amazing. As time goes on, we realize that we're always the stupid ones. Our bodies are always... Therein lies God's intelligence. So, but hey, Meredith, you probably have a question. I'll turn it over to you as we approach the top of the hour.
Right. I know we're finishing up, and I always learn so much from both of you. But just kind of wondering, from an implementation standpoint, how these fasting and dietary strategies may differ between type 1 and type 2 diabetes clients.
Well, type 1 is completely different. It's the severe lack of insulin. So at first you have to give it insulin. What's really interesting about type 1 diabetes is that they develop all the same diseases as type 2 diabetes. So if you think about it, it's very interesting because what happens is that when you follow type 1s, so you give them, at first they have no insulin, so you give them insulin, everything's fine. But then 30 years later, they're gaining weight, they're getting metabolic syndrome, and you can measure that they have insulin resistance. And with the insulin resistance, which is actually, it's not useful to call it insulin resistance. I call it hyperinsulinemia because it's a much more powerful way to look at it. If you see the problem is too much insulin, then the answer is super obvious, lower. So anyway, they all have signs of hyperinsulinemia, and then they get their heart attacks and strokes. So what's interesting is that if they're getting signs of too much insulin, it can only be because we gave it to them, because their body actually doesn't make any. So they, in fact, have double diabetes. They have type 1 diabetes, which is that their pancreas doesn't make it, but they actually have type 2 because they have insulin resistance and hyperinsulinemia. Mm-hmm. So the solution then becomes very obvious again. The point is that there's two toxicities in type 1. You have the glucotoxicity, that is if your blood glucose goes very high for a very long time, it's a problem. But you have insulin toxicity as well. If you take too much insulin for too long a time, you have a problem. And they have both. So if you have both glucotoxicity and insulin toxicity, you have to lower both your glucose and your insulin because, and the way to do that is eat a very low carbohydrate diet or add some intermittent fasting. Because therefore, if you don't eat, for example, 24 hours twice a week, for example, you reduce the need for insulin because you're not eating. So therefore, you don't have to inject so much. And therefore, you're going to lower the amount of insulin that you need in the long term. It's very interesting because type 1s, if you look at who lives the longest, they had several studies on this. And they followed a so-called golden years cohort of type 1s who had lived for 50 years and done very well. And they said, okay, let's look at these people and see what is it that they did very well at. Their average blood glucose, their A1C was 7.6%, which is not that good. In fact, not a single one of those people who had lived 50 years with type 1 had a normal blood glucose. What they all had was a low insulin dose because there's two toxicities, glucotoxicity and insulin toxicity. Our mistake in type 2 diabetes was thinking, and type 1 as well, was thinking that you can lower the blood glucose by raising the insulin. But you're only trading glucotoxicity for more insulin toxicity. You actually have to lower both in order to do well. And that's the answer. So you go to low carbohydrate diets, just as you said, and then intermittent fasting, which is sort of the ultimate strategy for that.
It is the ultimate strategy, because what people don't understand is every time you eat, you create a glucose and insulin spike. I don't care if it's a salad, right? The only way really to have perfect glucose insulin is not eat. But of course we know we need to eat, right? So, that's why my little saying has become, don't eat less often, because when you're not eating in spells, you have this perfect state of insulin and glucose, and you're making your body burn it. Either you're storing glucose or burning it, right? So, yeah. I mean, that's really the only state the body can be in. Am I right on that?
Yeah, absolutely. And this is the thing I tell patients. I say, well, look, think about it this way. If you don't eat, what you're doing is making your body eat that blood glucose. And when that's done, it's going to eat your body fat. So if you fast for 3 days, you're basically eating breakfast, lunch, and dinner of your own body fat.
Yeah.
And that's perfect. That's exactly what I want it to do. And everybody always worries about nutrient density and so on. And it's like, okay, but that's not the problem I'm treating here. It's you can take a multivitamin, but obesity is not a nutrient deficient disease. Like, what am I treating? Scurvy? Like, scurvy is a nutrient deficient disease. Beriberi is a nutrient deficient disease. Uh-huh. That's not what I'm treating here. I'm treating obesity, type 2 diabetes. So know what you're treating. And if you're worried about certain nutrients, then you can replenish them. That's the easiest thing to do.
You hit on one of my pet peeves, because in the alternative world, everyone is so focused on the micronutrients when the diseases we're seeing are about the macronutrients, the overconsumption of macronutrients, whether it be protein, carbohydrates, right, in the sugars. You know, it's like, and everyone's like, you know, thinking about it's this vitamin, it's that vitamin. Really, if you solve the macronutrient problem, you know, the few micronutrient issues typically take care of themselves as well, right? I think our focus is in the wrong place.
Exactly. It's completely the wrong thing because everybody's always saying, what am I not eating enough of that is making me obese and type 2 diabetic? Yeah. And it's like, the answer is nothing. You've got everything you need.
Yes.
That's not the question.
It's an overflow, right? It's an overflow.
It's an overflow. So they've gone in the wrong direction right from the beginning. And why is that? Well, because there's a lot of money to be made in selling supplements and all these sort of things. But really, from a scientific standpoint, really, it's what do you have too much of, not too little of. So when you approach it that way, you see that the answer is completely different. Like the solutions that present themselves are completely different. Yeah. And again, the advantage, it's such an incredible idea because we have all these diseases, heart disease, strokes, and cancer, the biggest killers of Americans, all related to metabolic syndrome, obesity, type 2 diabetes. And yet, we tell people that it's all chronic and progressive, but the truth is that they could start themselves tomorrow, today, to start fixing the problem.
No.
They listen to this podcast and you can start right now and start fixing the problem.
Don't eat less.
That powerful.
Listen, when we look at all the studies on living longer, you know, everyone thinks it's eating less, eating less, eating less, but really, you know, these countries, they're not eating less. They're eating less often. I was in an African culture and, you know, they didn't eat. You know, when you look at how many times Americans eat, you know, it's the, you know, whatever calories they're doing, right? It's the kombucha, it's the nuts, it's the whatever it is. They're constantly eating, really. And then they'll tell you that they only eat 2 meals a day or 3 meals a day. But really, you know, when you analyze it, they're eating a lot more than that. You know, the solution is eat less often.
Exactly. I think it's a huge part of the problem that really doesn't get talked about because if you look at the big NHANES surveys of Americans, 1977, the number of times people ate in a day was 3, breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And I grew up in the 70s. That was it. There was no snacks. There's no after school snack, nothing. No bedtime snack, no eating at the, you know, in front of the TV. And then you go to 2004 and the number of times people ate in a day averaged closer to 6. It's like, okay, so we're eating all the time. So if you're eating all the time, you're stimulating insulin all the time, which is giving your body the instruction to store food energy. So if you're always storing it in, then you're not going to burn it. Not that hard to imagine how you gain weight with that.
Yeah, no, exactly. Listen, kids can't go through a day of school today without snack time.
I know.
Yeah, it's like, you know, so we're starting obesity and insulin resistance with snack time. I don't care if it's a healthy snack. You know, either you're burning your glucose or you're storing it, and we just keep storing it, not burning, you know. So, yeah, I mean, and there lies the problem. However, at least get rid of the darn fructose and the sugars and then start eating less. Don't take away your kids' snacks, for goodness sakes. There's a good starting point, right? 3 meals a day, and then you can go to 2, especially if you already have an issue. And then you can start fasting. I mean, we gave the answer, Doc. I mean, come on.
The answer's right here.
Yeah, exactly.
You and I, we grew up in an age where everybody ate 3 meals a day, breakfast, lunch, dinner, and everybody was fine. Now we imagine that every child in America and Canada must eat snacks. It's like, isn't that that's the most ridiculous? Like, you know, we had a whole generations of kids do fine.
Yeah, absolutely. And we think that it has to be, you know, but partly because they go, yeah, but when they don't get their snack, they can't focus. And when we give them the sugar, then they focus. Yeah. Because they don't even know how to use fat at the cellular energy, right? So they just eat sugar high to sugar high to sugar high because they're like, you know, they're never burning their own fat. So they just need the next sugar hit, next sugar hit, next sugar hit.
Yeah. Then we call them ADHD and start medicating them on the other side, right? And like,
Right? I mean, as insane as that sounds that you just said, that is what we're doing. You know, we're snacking them. We're giving them sugar. You know, and think about it. Oh, but they don't count the orange juice, the healthy juice that they drank, loaded with fructose, as even a snack, right? It's like, so it's juice, it's snack, it's juice, it's snack. It's all day long, and then we'll eventually medicate them. You know, oh my God, I better stop because I'm like, wow. All right, Meredith, you better shut me down. Hey, Doc, thank you. You know, we love you. We love your work. We appreciate you so much. You know, my group of doctors does, and everyone who watches the show. So thank you very much.
Oh, thanks for having me. This was great.
Awesome. Thank you both. Always, you know, both such a wealth of knowledge, and I can tell you, you're so passionate about this topic, and it's really, it's going to take a culture change. So all of you who are watching out there too, I hope you spread this message, you know, share the podcast with everyone out there, because this is, you know, what we need to do to make a change.
People need to hear this message. Share it. You're right, Meredith. My gosh. It's like, you know how many lives will change if you share this? I'm telling you, people need to hear this. Anyone who has a kid, you better send them this. That's a good point, Meredith.
Yeah.
Thanks. No more snacks. All right. All right. Thank you so much, Dr. Fung. Thank you, Dr. Pompa. Everybody have a great weekend. We'll catch you next time. Bye-bye.
Thanks very much.
Bye-bye.